guided care for the elderly, programs for rural care, flu hotlines, and what's up with restraints. If that's what you're looking for, you found it. It's The Nursing Show. Well, good day and welcome to this week's episode of The Nursing Show. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the pod medic, and of course, I'd like to welcome all of our brand new listeners as we roll into the new school semester here in the next week or so for a lot of you. The nursing students that haven't discovered The Nursing Show are picking us up, and it's always great to welcome you and wish you all good luck in your studies. If you have any questions or comments or need more information about anything we discuss here on The Nursing Show, there's a couple of ways to get back in touch with us and to follow up on that. First of all, you can always go to nursingshow.com and you'll find links for the show notes for each and every episode, all of the news items we cover, all of the tip links we have. I always provide several resources for additional information that you can follow up on what I talk about in the show and get more details. So always follow up on everything we talk about. Also, you can ask questions, send in those questions and comments, yes, even corrections to comments@nursingshow.com. I love to hear from everybody. So however you get a hold of me, whether it's finding me over at Facebook, facebook.com/podmedic, or over at Twitter, twitter.com/podmedic, either way, I always love to hear back from the listeners. So drop me a line and let me know what you're up to and how things are going. Of course, for all of the long-term listeners, thank you again for all of your comments, getting in touch with me here at the show, sending me those emails with links and information, a great way to keep things moving and keep information flowing here in the Nursing Show community. If you'd like to get a lot of these links and information sent to you directly, you can get the show notes and links sent to you every single week just by signing up for the Nursing Show newsletter. You can find out how to do that. There's a form right there on the front page of the website. Just a name and email address real quick, and then we will get you squared away. And the next time an episode's released, you'll get the show notes links sent directly to your email inbox. Time to jump on into this week's news, and I'll lead off with a story I picked up having to do with costs of health care for individuals, and especially for older individuals. You know, our elderly patients really require a larger percentage of our attention than our younger patients do, just because of chronic disease issues that happen with age. And because of this, the costs of caring for these patients can be much, much greater and cause a greater than proportional burden on the healthcare system. And in the midst of all of the discussions on healthcare reform and how do we can reduce costs and how that's going to work, one of the problems that we constantly run into is how do we deal with this disproportionate cost? How can you reduce costs in a population that is requiring more and more care every year? One of the things that was found was that there may be fewer interventions necessary for these patients than previously thought, as long as there was some support network for those patients to get regular care and follow up on the care that is already in progress. And this is really going to make sense to a lot of you. I think this is really what a lot of nursing care is about, is ongoing care for the patient and responding to many different stress avenues that come in to affect the patient's overall health. So what this particular article that I found over at Medical News Today looks at is a study by researchers at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. And in this particular article and study, they looked at a controlled trial where they looked at patients who were being handled through some kind of a guided care program. Guided care basically meaning that they have their health care tracked and covered by a good team of nurses and physicians as their primary care resource, and that this frontline team that manages many aspects of their health care, rather than just going to see a multitude of specialists who never touch base with each other, there was actually a reduction in the costs for the patient. Guided care patients, according to one of the study's authors, are costing health insurers about 11% less than patients in their control group. And I think that this is important because this is just a significant reduction in healthcare costs, 11% across the board for the patients that have a guided care option in this elderly age group. So it's just something to consider. It's something to look at how we connect the care for our patients. Patients that see different specialists, how often and how frequently do their primary care physicians keep track of what's going on and with all their specialists? And of course, because the specialists are paid so much more, that's a lot of extra time for the lesser paid primary care physician and nursing groups. How are we supposed to manage those costs? So perhaps there needs to be some resource to additionally fund primary care physicians for following up on care, perhaps an additional fee for that follow-up care. Something that should be considered, I think, definitely, because otherwise many primary care physicians just don't have the time to manage multiple patients beyond seeing them in the office, and there needs to be a resource to do that. And of course, I think nurses are going to play a key role in that regard. Next up, let's look at two stories in the news about flu. First off, a report I picked up over at the Reuters news service, and it's looking at the use of some of the flu drugs like Tamiflu and Relenza and whether or not they are really necessary for treating some of the patients with the H1N1 swine flu virus. And what we found and what they found is that they British researchers are reporting that they don't think that the recommendation for the use of antiviral drugs is necessary for adults without other complications associated with the presence of the swine flu. That most healthy adults will have no problem dealing with the flu with common treatments without resorting to the use of antiviral drugs. Now, there's been some concern about the supplies of antiviral drugs in the face of a global pandemic, and that patients that are needing the drugs in less served or underserved areas may not get the drug that they need to treat the problems in the face of their other concurrent health issues. But this particular article is saying that healthy adults do not need the flu drugs, Tamiflu and Relenza and others that may be along, and that means that more of those medications will be available for patients that are immunocompromised or have other health issues that make contracting the swine flu that much more dangerous for them. So I think it's important to understand the World Health Organization strongly recommends both drugs for certain patients, including pregnant women, anybody with an underlying medical condition, and then children under the age of 5, because they are at such increased risk for a severe case and severe complications associated with swine flu. I just want to keep these kinds of things on your radar, because these are the kind of questions that you as a nurse are going to be asked by family members, neighbors, and even bystanders who find out you're a nurse. They may ask a question about this, and you can certainly relay to them that there seems to be no recommendation for the average adult to need more than just general flu care, that you're going to have to let it run its course, and that we should save the medications for people with real health issues. And finally, in a related swine flu story, you know, one of the concerns that many people have about contracting swine flu and the spread of the disease is how it will be easy to spread this disease from person to person in places where sick people congregate, such as a hospital emergency room. You know, sitting for hours while you wait to be treated for what is relatively a minor problem is going to be a bigger issue if you leave with a disease you didn't show up with. So what are we going to do to deal with this? One of the solutions that is being proposed is setting up some kind of a flu hotline, some kind of a resource for patients to get the information they need and find out about how to treat themselves without having to come in to a hospital. This way, a patient could go online or call into a hotline and use a push button menu system that would allow them to get their questions answered about how serious they need to treat certain symptoms and when should they make the decision when a trip to their doctors or an emergency room is necessary for their particular symptoms and related to the onset and severity of their symptoms. And it's hoped that hotlines like this and websites and information sources like this will help alleviate some of the flood of people that might not ordinarily in flu season have come into the emergency room, but because of fears associated with the H1N1 or swine flu virus, are likely more likely to come in worried about a more severe problem than they might already have. And of course, this will spread more of the disease to other patients who may be sick with other problems, and now they have swine flu on top of it. So it'll be interesting to see how these things play out. Again, I will continue to report on things like this because I think it's important as the flu season approaches here in the next month, month and a half, that we are ready and prepared to give our patients a good answer and a qualified answer about what needs to be done to deal with their own personal health and their and to protect them from contracting illnesses from other people. Tip of the week this week, we're going to talk a little bit about patient restraints, why we use them, why we may not have to use them, or maybe should find other resources not to use them, and when they may, if they are appropriate, when and how we should be dealing with patients and restraints. Some of the guidelines that I found out there, and I'll relay a lot of this information to you. There are a couple of links in the show notes that you should follow up on. Both two of them to the Joint Commission on different aspects of patient safety and handling of restraints. And this is an issue that has to do with patient safety. Patients who are restrained are less mobile and are more likely to not injure other people, but they may end up having other health concerns and other injuries associated with being restrained and perhaps even die if they're not restrained properly. So there's a lot of things associated with patient restraint. And of course, in a psychological setting, a patient who is restrained when you're trying to encourage them to exhibit good behavior and exhibit self-control, well, they don't need to exhibit self-control if they are restrained. So there needs to be some trade-off and some way to remove those restraints and enable them to regain control again, whether it's after administration of some calming medications and sedatives or something else that helps them to exhibit personal control and mastery over themselves so that they don't have to be restrained, because that will go against other treatments that may be encouraging them to take appropriate actions and exhibit good behaviors. We talked about mobility in last week's show, so if you want a review of some of the issues associated with reduced mobility in our patients, you can check that out. But there are some times when we do need to restrain our patients, and is there a difference between actively restraining our patients using tie downs and having a patient with limited mobility and having them constantly in a bed with side rails up? That's something that you need to consider with each and every patient. We want to protect them from falling out of bed, but we also want to enable them to have the ability to move safely on their own when they choose to do so, if they're able to. And so we need to weigh barriers that we put in a patient's way versus active restraints, because we may be restraining patients while we are not actively restraining them in the traditional sense of tie down restraints or things like that. Now, restraints will restrict someone's freedom of voluntary movement, and they also restrict the patient's access to their own body, which can cause a whole host of other issues. They can't wipe their nose. They can't scratch an itch. There are things we can do with restraints that cause a patient to not be able to deal with normal bodily functions or deal with normal bodily annoyances, and we need to make sure that we're carefully assessing and reassessing our restrained patients, because this is not something we should be doing lightly. Obviously, it takes a physician's order to order restraints, and the physician should be following up on that order for restraints with a visual face-to-face assessment so that they can decide whether restraints are still necessary, how long the restraints should be applied, and if there is a need for a chemical restraint. Now, that brings up two different types of restraints. We have chemical and physical restraints. Chemical restraints are any medication that is being used to slow or restrain the patient chemically. Sedatives, and anesthesia, general anesthesia, is indeed a form of chemical restraint and a necessary one, because obviously we don't need patients awake and moving around during a surgical procedure. So chemical restraint is indicated in those patients. Physical restraints are, again, tie downs, physical tie downs, where you have the buckled wristbands that then tie down to the bed frame. You can do the same thing with ankle restraints. Patients may also have a belt restraint. Elderly patients, Alzheimer's patients, to keep them from wandering at night, often have some form of, may have a belt restraint that's applied that keeps them in bed. It's a waistband that then ties down or attaches to the bed frame. All of these things have their own dangers associated with them. If this patient is incontinent and they are not able to get out of the wetness or out of the messy stools that are now in their bed, we cause additional skin breakdown with these kinds of restraints. So it's something that is needed to be monitored. So oftentimes these restraints are replaced with other kinds of security or alarm devices now, rather than tying the patient physically down to the bed. Other things to be concerned about is what kind of things do we have as far as patient history? What has worked in the past? And many times we have patients that are coming from a home or other facilities. Find out in your turnover of care or from patient family members what is used at home or in the other location to assist this patient with some control or restraint issues. We need to understand what the problem is for the restraint. So we need to have a reason for the restraint. We need to have exhibited that we've tried other ways to keep track of the patient and protect the patient's safety and the safety of those around them. And so we can document all of these things appropriately. And we'll talk about documentation a little bit later. There are two different types of management for different types of restraints. There's a behavior management standard, and that's for psychological patients. In psych settings, there are going to be certain standards that are applied. In a medical surgical standard or setting, there is a different standard, and that's because in med-surg, we may be restraining a patient who is coming out from general anesthesia. Until they become fully aware, we are protecting them from themselves. It's a limited restraint. We are monitoring them carefully, usually in a post-surgical setting. They are very closely monitored by nursing staff, and so this restraints are not as worrisome there, because they are closely monitored and they are limited in their scope, because we're anticipating a patient that comes back around. Patients in an ICU setting who are intubated, we don't want them to forcibly extubate themselves, so we restrain their hands so they can't get to the ET tube. This is something we want to limit as much as possible. We want to get them off of that ET tube. So there are certain settings where that may not be necessary, and you want to make sure that you're monitoring these patients carefully. What about some other things that we can use as alternatives? Well, we want to think about other ways to distract the patient or keep them in bed. Perhaps patients are going to be restless at a certain time of day. In case perhaps dementia patients, we can encourage visitors to come at that certain time of a day, which will enable them to free up nursing staff, and those visitors can keep the patient occupied and therefore keep them from wandering or getting out of bed. There are other alternatives, whether it's use of an alarm system, the pressure pads in the bed. When you make the bed, put a pressure pad under the patient. When they get out of bed, the pressure pad alarm goes off, alerting you that the patient has gotten out of their bed, and that tells you that you need to go back in and get them squared away again. There are different types of things that I've seen used like that, from wristbands that, you know, have a proximity alarm. When they get too far away from the alarm box, the wristband causes loss of signal causes the alarm box to go off. These are all alternatives to using tie-down restraints. But one thing is clear: in the current climate, there is definitely a trend towards decreasing our use of traditional tie-down restraints and moving towards some of these other alternatives. And so I would urge you to look at the facility guidelines where you work and try to examine whether there needs to be additional alternatives proposed. There's lots of resources online for proposing different alternatives. Is there a client or patient rights or advocacy person in the facility who is monitoring the use of restraints, or at least getting reports on how often restraints are being used and monitoring whether they were applied appropriately? Not because we want to discipline anyone, but because we can then go in and find out if there are alternatives that would work better and examine each patient on a case-by-case basis. The ultimate goal here is to improve and maintain a good quality of life for all patients, even those that may need a little bit more guidance than others. We don't tie up our toddlers or our three-year-olds. We just watch them more closely. We put them in a setting where they can't hurt themselves. We move things out of their reach. The same thing can be done for elderly patients who require restraint. And again, we just need to make individualized care our hallmark and what we use to determine on a case-by-case basis how we're going to monitor patients so that we don't have to use restraints. Some things to keep in mind. Again, restraints should be avoided if at all possible. They should cause us to trigger some sort of an in-house review of why the restraints were needed, how they were used, how long they were used, and what alternatives were tried, so that we can avoid using restraints in the same situation at another time if possible. They should not, and according to Joint Commission rules, should not and can't be used as a substitute for having someone sit with the patient. Just because you're short-staffed, that's not an excuse to tie the patient down. You should have, if someone's supposed to be monitoring that patient continuously and that was all they need to be safe, that's what should be supplied for them. Restraints should only be used on a short-term basis. They should frequently be monitored when on restraints and frequently reassessed and reevaluated for complications associated with those restraints, including chafing, skin breakdown, checking for pulses distal to the location of the restraints, checking for injuries and other things associated with the restraints, such as incontinence. Also, again, a physician's order specifically and a review by the physician. If it's put on in an emergency setting, the physician should review within 1 hour of the placement of the restraints and always use the least restrictive form of restraint possible. So if you can get away with a simple arm tie down to keep the patient from pulling out their IV line, that may be all that's necessary. You don't have to apply ankle restraints to those patients. And so you need to kind of go with the least common denominator for these situations. Again, documentation, as always, is key. Get those nursing notes entered into the patient record so that you can make sure that the reasons for use of restraints are documented and assessment and follow-up are all documented. We should have a behavioral assessment prior to the implementation. Alternatives, what has been tried this time to avoid the use of restraints and what results occurred after those alternatives were worked out? What about the client's status? Has a client's family member or caregiver been notified about the consent for using restraints or notified about the use of restraints and how the situation worked out? An explanation to the patient and family after the fact why the restraints were used, what type of restraint, how it was used, where it was applied, where it was tied to the bed frame. All of these details are very important in case there's some kind of follow-up. We need to paint a very clear picture of exactly how restraints were used. We should document the time they were applied and the time they were released. And we should document each time that we reevaluate the patient or check on the patient during the time that restraints were applied. And when the physician's involvement, that all should be clearly documented in the nursing notes. When the physician was called, when they actually came in, what their response was, and make sure that those orders are very clearly laid out according to your facility guidelines. So that's a review of restraints, when they should be used, a little bit about what to think about regarding the use of restraints, and also especially important things to document associated with the use of restraints. And that's going to wrap up this week's episode of The Nursing Show. I want to thank everybody for checking out the show this week and remind you that you can find links to everything we talked about, including the news items as well as additional resources for this week's tip of the week in The Nursing Show blog over at nursingshow.com. You'll find the RN or Nursing Podcast category there, and you'll find all of the episode show notes going back in time from this one all the way back to the very beginning, so you can follow up on any episode you've ever listened to. And that's what you need to do. You need to follow up on this information and make sure you understand how to apply it to your own nursing practice. I want to also remind you, you can get a hold of me by sending emails to comments@nursingshow.com, and you can also always leave comments right there on the Nursing Show site on any of the articles that you find over there. This week's song of the week is going to close out our show. It's from the PodSafe Music Network at music.podshow.com. And it's a song by Whitney Steele. It's called Your Turn to Cry. Like Whitney's music a lot, I urge you to check it out and listen to it. And follow up on the link in the show notes if you like her songs. You can pick up her music there through that link. You can also buy it directly at iTunes. I have a link there for that as well. But whatever you do, let her know you heard it here on The Nursing Show. In the meantime, I want to remind you, I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic. Don't forget to stay safe and stay tuned here to The Nursing Show. Take care.
So much on my mind. It's up to me to find my way, and I'm leaving you behind. It helps every time you look me in the eyes, 'cause that's when I see right through. Goodbye. to cry.